Leadership in today's world is complex. It involves many polarities. Polarities like autonomy and control, support and accountability, love and truth. Effective leadership requires us to move beyond the common either-or thinking. It requires us to embrace both and thinking, not choosing one or the other, but integrating both ideas. The next two episodes of the podcast, we've got a very special guest, Kim Scott. She's here to discuss one of the most prevalent polarities in leadership today, candor and compassion. Kim Scott is a New York Times bestselling author and leadership expert known for her groundbreaking work in fostering effective communication and leadership practices. With a wealth of experience in Silicon Valley and beyond, Kim has established herself as a prominent advocate for building strong, engaged teams through a concept she has coined as radical candor. Kim's insights draw from a diverse background that includes roles at some of the world's most innovative companies, including Google and Apple. Her book, Radical Candor, Be a Kick-Ass Boss Without Losing Your Humanity, has gained global recognition for its transformative approach to feedback, communication, and leadership. In today's episode, she shares some of the core principles of radical candor that apply to all leaders and all cultures. And then in the second episode of our conversation with Kim, she's going to dive deep into the practical tools and strategies helping us to be radically candid with our athletes and staff. Welcome to the Coaching Culture Podcast. I'm your host, JP Nurbin, and I'm joined by my friend and co-host, Nate Sanderson. The mission of this podcast is to help you become a better leader and build a better culture. In addition to this podcast, I'm the founder of TOC, which provides one-on-one coaching and consulting for leaders. Learn more about us at tocculture.com. This episode is brought to you by the TOC newsletter. Every Thursday, our newsletter includes two things you don't want to miss out on. Firstly, the notes to that week's podcast episode. Whether you're listening while driving the car, out for a run, or doing the dishes, we don't want you to miss the biggest takeaways from each episode. Secondly, each newsletter is a short article from myself or Nate on leadership and culture. These articles are designed to inspire, encourage, and provide practical insights into leadership and culture building. Our content is a perfect fit for anyone who wants to stay up to date with the latest trends and insights in culture building. You can subscribe to the newsletter at tocculture.com or by clicking on the link in the details of each episode.
All right, Kim, well, it's great to have you with us on the podcast here. And usually we like to start with a story just to familiarize our audience a little bit with your background without necessarily going through your bio. So I'm going to prompt you with a question here. When we think about kind of your experience at Google and Apple and experiences before that, a lot of our audience probably can identify with some stories they've heard about Steve Jobs. There's this mythology about his leadership and his style. You use lots of anecdotes in the book talking about what you've learned in your experiences with Apple and with him. And so I wonder if you could just maybe start there in terms of what is it that you take away most from being so close to the leadership of Steve Jobs at Apple?
You know, I think that there's a misperception about Steve Jobs that he was just a total jerk. And that you have to be a jerk in order to be a super successful leader. And if there's one myth that I want to bust in radical candor, it's that myth. Because I think great leaders, the best leaders, are actually super compassionate. And I think even Steve Jobs, I mean, you know, I'm not going to say he was like a kind and gentle leader, but for the, he chose a team of people who worked closely with him. And they loved working with him. Not everyone would love working with him, but when Steve Jobs was dying, Tim Cook offered Steve half his liver. And I don't know of a word to explain, and Steve refused the sacrifice, you know, and I don't know of a word to explain the behavior between those two men other than love. And if, you know, when I was at Apple, you would see Steve like having lunch with Johnny Ive, and they clearly were enjoying having lunch together. You know, it was a good, he surrounded himself with people with whom he had great relationships, with Scott Forstall, who started the iOS team. he had a great relationship. He really understood, at least what appeared. I mean, you know, you can never judge another person's relationship, but there was it appeared that there was a lot of care personally and challenge directly in those relationships. And so I think that's one thing that I would like to dispel. Another myth, I think, about Steve Jobs's leadership style is that it was command and control. You know, Steve told people what to do, but he really didn't. There was this notion at Apple of the directly responsible individual, and those people were responsible for their work. Nobody was telling them what to do. In fact, there's a good interview I can send you for the show notes. There's a good interview with Steve Jobs where he says, "At Apple, we hire people who tell us what to do, not the other way around." And so I think he was a complicated character, certainly, but I think there's the myths are incorrect that he was this, you know, tyrannical jerk. He was more than that.
So there's actually two things I want to pull on in there. One is that word love you use, but before I jump to that, there's a question around this, your identity, right? So Steve Jobs knew who he was. He knew the kind of the culture that they were trying to create at Apple. And that differs than maybe the culture at Google, which I know a little bit from my own personal experience. My wife worked at Amazon. Now she works at Google. And those are very different cultures, but they often work for the people within them. I was just kind of curious if you could kind of maybe speak to this varying cultures and how leaders operate within them, within their own identity to be authentic.
Yeah. So I think that there are some things that are sort of universally true. Like love and truth are important in leadership. So that's what I think of as challenging directly and caring personally are universal human values. But they are expressed differently culture to culture and person to person. And so I would characterize Google's culture as, you know, sort of radically candid with maybe a dose of ruinous empathy. There's a lot of care personally in the culture. And by the way, that's kind of the theoretical Google, the aspirational Google. There are people who did not experience care personally at all at Google. I just want to be clear about that. I don't want to take anything away. You know, nothing that I'm saying is absolute. And then I would describe Apple's culture as radically candid with maybe a dose of obnoxious aggression. Like it was very focused on challenge directly. And, you know, it was also interesting. Google's culture is kind of like, you know, let 1,000 flowers bloom. And Apple's culture is very much cultivate 1 or 2 or 3 or 4, maybe 4 flowers. And so it's a different approach to innovation. And both work, by the way. And I think that different approach is probably more a reflection of the products, actually, than the leader. Apple was making hardware. Google was not making hardware. And so at Google, it was easier to have this launch and iterate because you could iterate after you launched at Google. You could push new software. Whereas once you have made a physical product, you know, it's much more difficult to iterate on it. It's out there. It's gone. You know, here's my phone. Lots of luck iterating on it. And so I think that is, you know, it's also important to think about what the companies do. But one of my favorite, here's two examples from the two companies that explain the difference between the culture. Yeah, or am I going too deep for you? You want
to
hear it?
No, give it to us.
Okay. So both companies, I mean, they're 15 minutes apart from each other, the main campus, Cupertino and Mountain View, are very close here in Silicon Valley. And they're both kind of spread out, the campuses or buildings. And so in order to get from meeting to meeting, at both companies, they provided bicycles. And at Google, the bicycles were multicolored And it was total chaos. Like, you'd jump on a bike, you'd ride to another place, you weren't allowed to lock up the bike. And very often you would walk out of the building and there were no bikes, and then you were kind of stranded. But it was fun, you know, it was sort of, you'd see the CEO riding a bike, you know, so it was a little chaotic, colorful, fun, and not always perfectly organized. Whereas at Apple, all the bikes were silver with a red bell. You checked them out with a lock and you would ride to your next destination. You'd lock it up and then you'd unlock it and ride it back. So you never got stranded. So it was maybe a little bit less efficient from the bicycle's point of view, but way more efficient from the rider's point, from the user's point of view. And to me, that's like that summarizes the difference between the two cultures right there. Also, lunch. Lunch is another good example. So lunch at Google, I mean, both companies have great food. Lunch at Google, it's all organic and it's delicious, but it's kind of a smorgasbord. You got to figure out what you want to eat and kind of put it together yourself. Whereas at Apple, you pay a little bit for lunch, but it is all put together neatly and beautifully on a plate for you. It's like a restaurant meal, not a smorgasbord. And to me, that kind of summarized the difference between the two cultures as well. I would say that the food at Apple is a little better than the food at Google.
Well, I'll let my wife know that. All right, yeah. I have to reconsider here.
But you do have to pay for it, but it's worth it.
Oh, there you go. So what I think is so fascinating about it is that at the end of the day, both work, right? The culture works and they look a little bit different. But what you said, you know, comes back to like, there's still some underlying principles, right? That it comes back to. And I think that's what your book really speaks to is those underlying principles. And one of the things that I think I just want to touch on here is you use the word love, right? There was love with Steve Jobs. And I remember reading in Radical Candor, how you actually didn't want to name it Radical Candor to begin with. You wanted to call it Compassionate Candor.
But yes.
You didn't think it'd sell as well, which I agree to. But, you know, I think that's just a great entry point into, you know, what is Radical Candor, you know, because I thought I actually love the term Compassionate Candor as well.
Yeah. So Radical Candor is what happens when you show that you care personally and you challenge someone directly at the same time. And I think it may be easy to explain what radical candor is by also explaining what it isn't. So radical candor is not obnoxious aggression. Obnoxious aggression is what happens when you challenge directly without showing that you care personally. And obnoxious aggression is a big problem. It's a problem because it hurts people. It's also a problem because it's inefficient. Usually, if you're a jerk to someone else, they begin to go into fight or flight mode, and then they literally can't hear what you're saying, so you're wasting your breath. And it's also a problem because I don't know about you all, but for me, when I realize I've acted like a jerk, it's not actually my instinct to go the right direction on care personally. Instead, it's my instinct to go the wrong way on challenge directly and say, oh, it's no big deal. Don't worry about it. But it is a big deal. That's why I said, you know, now I'm leaving the person both confused and I've sort of got and upset. And now I've moved to the worst place of all, which is what I call manipulative insincerity. That's what happens when you neither care nor challenge. And we all do this. I mean, it sounds so harsh, manipulative insincerity, but I can tell you 10 stories from yesterday about moments in my day when I sort of retreated to that kind of behavior. And then the worst thing that it's fun to tell stories about obnoxious aggression and manipulative insincerity, but those are not the most common mistakes that we make. By far and away, the most common mistake that most of us make on a regular basis is ruinous empathy. And that's what happens when we do remember to show that we care personally, because it turns out most people are actually pretty nice people. So we do remember to show that we care personally, but we fail to tell someone something they'd be better off knowing in the long run. And that's ruinous empathy. And that's really what I'm trying to help people avoid with the book Radical Candor. But you're right. Compassionate candor would be a more accurate description of what I mean, but wouldn't have sold as many books.
This episode is brought to you by the Culture System Online Training Platform. It's the ultimate resource for coaches who want to become more transformational and build winning team cultures. Whether you're just starting out or looking to take your coaching to the next level, our one-of-a-kind online training platform is designed to help you learn the culture system framework at your own pace. Through this course, I'll share with you the proven methods, tools, and strategies used by some of the best teams and organizations in the world. You'll get access to customizable digital tools and a group chat to engage with experienced coaches and apply the four-part framework throughout your season. With the Culture System Online Training, you'll be inspired and transformed through the stories and lessons of real leaders who've successfully applied these methods and tools within their organizations. You'll gain a deeper commitment to transformational coaching and be equipped with the tools and strategies you need to build a great team culture. To get access to this course today, simply go to tocculture.com and click on the online course tab, or click on the link provided in the details of this episode. Don't miss this opportunity to become a more transformational coach and take your team to the next level with the Culture System Online Training Platform.
Well, you mentioned off-air that you've got some kids that have a sports background, and our audience is primarily coaches. And so I wonder, when you think about just radical candor and this balance between the challenge as well as the personal care, for coaches that are, you know, dealing with young people or at the college level, 18 to 22-year-olds, how would you apply some of those principles, or what would just be some initial tips that you might give to coaches when you're working with kids of trying to both balance? Obviously, we have to show that we care and that love is important, but there's also a place where challenge is needed. And I think even sometimes with young people who maybe aren't used to being challenged, it's almost like we have to educate them in some way about how this whole process works anyway.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. So one of the best examples I've ever seen of radical candor is my son's baseball coach. I was watching practice, and the kids were doing a drill, and they were running bases, and, you know, they had to touch each base, obviously. And one kid kept missing the base in this drill. And the coach told him once, the coach told him twice. And then the third time he jumped in and he really kind of yelled at this kid, you know, you're missing. And then, and the kid started to cry a little bit. And the coach said to him, look, you can't do right if you don't know what you're doing wrong. And I'm telling you this because I want you to win some games. You know, I think you can be a great ball player, but you got to touch the, you can't miss the base. And I thought it was a great example of radical candor. And there's usually when I'm talking to business leaders, I talk about criticize in private. But when it comes to sports, you know, you got to yell in the moment. You know, back, you know, you don't want to whisper after the kid has been, you know, tagged out. Oh, you should have run back. You know, you got to correct in the moment. And so I thought this coach did a great job of that. I think the other thing that I will say about radical candor and coaching, especially coaching young people, is that it is the younger generation's job, and has been from the dawn of humanity. It's the younger generation's job to criticize the older generation. And that means, as a coach, I recommend starting by soliciting feedback. You know, don't dish it out till you prove you can take it. Because these kids have strong ideas about what's, and often they're correct. They're thinking about things in a new way. And I would say that this, I don't think it's a new thing about this. I have kids who are 14. I think I was the same way at 14. Like, I really wanted to tell my teachers, my coaches, my parents, like, what they were doing wrong. that's especially a teenager's instinct. And I think that it's a good idea to listen to what they're saying to you. I mean, they're not, you don't have to agree with it all the time, but listen to it, because often there's some wisdom there.
Yeah, we're going to dive a little bit more into that, you know, shortly on the feedback and, you know, handling criticism, because there's so much good stuff in your book on that. Before we jump into that, though, what really impressed me was, you know, here's a book for leaders that are working in large corporate America, you know, and you emphasized relationships so much. And the interesting thing that we're learning a lot about Generation Z and the newer generations of athletes that are coming in there, one of the biggest pieces of feedback that we're seeing on forms when we work with these teams at all levels, from collegiate Division I down to the youth level, is that the athletes want a relationship with their coaches these days. And you give a lot of great tips and strategies, and I think you kind of helped develop maybe some of the models for how to develop relationships at companies like Google and Apple. And I just wondered if you could speak to the importance of building those relationships so that you can challenge directly.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, again, I don't think this is new. I think people have always wanted to have a relation that we long for guidance as human beings. I mean, nobody really wants quote unquote feedback, because feedback is screechy and makes you want to put your hand over your ears. But we long for guidance. We long to learn from people who've been there ahead of us. And this is the job of a parent, of a teacher, of a coach, of a professor, of a manager, is to offer guidance. But you can't possibly, I mean, that's part of the job. I would say there's, if you're working with a group of people to achieve anything, whether it's winning a game or building a product or anything else, there's three, you're responsible for three things. You're responsible for creating this culture of guidance where people can tell each other what's going well and what's not going well. You're responsible for putting the right people in the right roles, for building a great team, and you're responsible for getting stuff done, for winning games or for building a product or whatever, turning a profit. And if you think about it, how can you do that with your team? If you think you can do those three things without building a relationship with your direct reports, you're just kidding yourself. There's ample evidence that shows that command and control doesn't work all that well, especially when you're trying to optimize for collaboration, to build a team where people are really cooperating with one another, and a team on which people have to respect one another. They have to, and by respect, there's two definitions of respect, which is kind of interesting. One is that is sort of respecting someone else's identity, feelings, you know, who they are, how they're feeling, how they're showing up that day. And that's something that we owe to everyone. The other is respect that has to be earned for some skill that's been developed over time. It's kind of confusing. But when I'm talking about respect, I'm like, this is something you owe to everyone, being respectful. So I think that if you think that you can create this psychologically safe environment where people can give each other feedback and give you feedback, and where they feel safe soliciting feedback, if you think that you can build a great team and understand who should be in which role, if you think you can get stuff done, if you can align a team around a set of goals without building relationships, you're wrong. You're kidding yourself.
Yeah, let me jump in there. I'm just curious, you know, when you think about coaches and athletes today, even, you know, because your son or daughter, or they're playing baseball.
Both of them. Yeah. Daughter's playing volleyball, son's playing baseball.
Daughter's playing volleyball. There you go. So, you know, what would be effective ways for coaches to start to build those relationships that you might have learned along the path here working with so many companies?
Yeah. It can be really quick. Building relationships it's really not about the bonding events, that it's about these moments that happen. So one of the very tactical things I tell people is when you're sitting down to have a staff meeting, if you're in corporate America, or a team meeting, if you're a coach, you want to, before you jump into what you're trying to tell people, you want to go around the room and let people have a couple of seconds each, like 30 seconds each. What's going on? Funny story from the weekend. Some kind of way that they can tell each other what they're bringing into that meeting with them from the rest of their lives. Because pretending like nothing else is happening except that meeting is wrong. It's incorrect. And sometimes it feels inefficient, these moments of chit-chat, this 5 or 10 minutes of chit-chat before you start. But it's actually really efficient, because if someone comes in and let's say their dog has just died, like they're looking upset and everybody else is like, oh, why is Kim mad at me? And I'm not mad at anybody. I'm upset because my dog has just died. But if you give a little bit of a moment for people to tell each other what's going on, then they better understand the mood that is coming into the room. So I think that's one very tactical thing. Just like connect before content. Before you jump into the strategy for the game, let people talk about what's going on for them. So simple things like that. I think another thing that coaches can do is sort of have conversations with each of their players. And this does not have to take, you know, an endless amount of time, but a little bit about what is their history, you know, what have they done before this moment? Have they played other sports? And you're sort of trying to understand what motivates each of your players or each of your team members. And so if someone used to swim and now they're playing baseball, ask why, you know, why, or maybe vice versa. And maybe you find out that beating a personal best is really important to the person, or teamwork is they want to be part of a team. Like, understand what motivates each person. And then you also want to sort of understand a little bit about where they're headed, their future. Like, imagine that you've achieved everything you want in your life. What does that look like? And maybe three different versions of what that looks like. Because another thing is that a mentor once said to me, only about 3% of us know what we want to do when we grow up, and they confuse the hell out of the rest of us. So getting it, like, let people dream a little bit with you, and then sort of figure out what can you do to help them stay motivated and take a step in the direction of their dreams. I think those are some things you can do to really get to know folks.
Okay, we're going to take a break in our conversation with Kim Scott. In the meantime, we should probably make some time for some self-reflection. What are we most guilty of? Is it ruinous empathy, manipulative insecurity, obnoxious aggression? We all probably have a tendency to lean towards one or the other. Our first step towards growth, though, is awareness. Once we become aware of our tendency, then we can improve on it. So take some time for self-reflection between now and the next episode. In the next episode, we're going to be unpacking with Kim some very practical ways to become more radically candid. All right, that's it for today's episode of the Coaching Culture Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Also, we're grateful for people who take 15 to 30 seconds just to leave us a review. And I know your friends appreciate it when you send them an episode that they find valuable. So don't hesitate to share today's episode.